This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. Arrests from the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol continue to mount across the country and here at home. New details from the FBI show some Capitol rioters, part of the pro-Trump mob that stormed Congress in an event that left five people dead, had next hoped to set their sights on another Capitol in Columbus. We start the weekly news review with Associated Press reporter Dan Sewell. Dan, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Oh, thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure to have you, and we'd like to have you as well. Join our conversation at 513-419-7100 or email your questions or comments to talk at WVXU.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We'll look for your comments and tweets there. Dan, we learned new information this week from federal authorities and the FBI about some of the people involved in those violent, harrowing scenes we saw out of Washington, D.C. earlier this month. And now we have a local connection. What can you tell us about what we learned?
Okay, well, the Oath Keepers are a fairly well-known group that dates to 2009, based out of, the leader is based in Montana. But what we learned this week with arrests were there's a group called the Ohio State Regular Militia, which apparently formed about less than 2 years ago in Waterloo, Ohio. Which I was not even familiar with that town, but it's in Champaign County, sort of northwest of Columbus. And two of the members were charged with this week with conspiracy and four or five other charges. And they were also charged with a man they knew as Commander, or they called Commander Tom from Virginia. And those were the first three people charged with conspiracy. Meaning that they are accused of helping plan and coordinate the Capitol attack.
And so these are people who were celebrating, apparently. The FBI had found messages that were being exchanged between them. You wrote it as exalting the breaching of the Capitol and also planning another move. What can you tell us about their communications?
Right. The FBI reported that Donovan Crowell was overheard saying, basically, you know, celebrating the Capitol breach and saying, we need local action now. We're ready. Basically, we're ready to go on to Columbus now to the State House there. And he was one of the Ohio State Regular Militia.
What do we know about the way the FBI was able to track these folks? We've seen a lot of reports that many of the people involved in the insurrection confessed themselves because of their live tweeting and live videoing of what was going on. What do we know about this case?
Very much the case here. They were using I hear it called Parler. It seems like it should be called Parlay.
Well, those of us who studied French would say that, but I think they do
right.
Just call it Parler.
Exactly. So the FBI obviously was monitoring that. So that's where they got, you know, a lot of the statements and comments. You know, they were using social media. So there's a lot available on as far as photos, audios, selfies they posted. So it's really, you know, I think the FBI had said something like they've got over 125,000 digital pieces of evidence already against those that they've arrested. And there's been, you know, a lot of crowd's efforts to identify people from social media, going back to their previous social media. Certainly the self-described commanding officer of the Ohio State Regular Militia, Jessica Watkins, who was one of those arrested this week, was quite active on social media. And, you know, able to go back now and see some of her earlier posts. She owns a bar called the Jolly Roger in Waterloo. And she had posted at one point, you know, an image of the bar on Saturday and said, look, we have no customers. Thanks for nothing, Mike DeWine. And it turns out at least three of the militia members had been at the State House November 7th, just in a peaceful protest against the election.
We're talking with Dan Sewell, a Cincinnati-based reporter for the Associated Press, and we're discussing Oath Keepers in the Ohio State Regular Militia and the ongoing arrest of people involved in the Capitol insurrection earlier this month and allegations of other plots that may have even involved the state capitol in Columbus. So as we talk about their communications, Dan, can you tell us a little bit of the specifics of what was expressed between these individuals? I know a lot of it was celebratory.
As it began, as the assault began, there was one message. The source wasn't identified, but a message to Jessica Watkins saying, you know, go for it, Jess. This is what we train. And of course, there are a lot of obscene words that were used around some of these messages. But they clearly had a plan. In fact, I think one of the definitive images is there's people, including at least one of those arrested from Ohio, who put their hands on each other's shoulders. They're all dressed in kind of olive drab helmets, goggles, very militaristic. And they used what's called the Ranger file in the military, which means it's a formation that's used when you're preparing to storm a building. It's called stacking up. So, Crowell was a former Marine. Watkins was former Army. I think the Associated Press last week identified 2 to 3 dozen suspected participants are either military or police.
And your reporting indicates that the Oath Keepers often recruits current and former military, police, or other first responders. And what we're seeing from these messages that have emerged and the backgrounds of these individuals is perhaps a picture that becomes clearer than what it was earlier this month. And it's not as spontaneous as it seemed, at least for some of the people involved, like the ones that we're talking about today, that there was some pretty serious coordination that was going on. Is that the indication you're getting from the federal investigators?
Yes. The FBI describes the Ohioans as dues-paying members of the Oath Keepers. And I think that was something that wasn't understood, although the founder of the Oath Keepers had talked about in the past of kind of creating these, units around the country. And it appears there's been coordination between these small, again, this Ohio group seems to be very small, with the umbrella group of the Oath Keepers. So I think there's a lot more that's still being learned about that.
I'll note that some of the comments that you include in your reporting, Dan, use militaristic language, as you've pointed out. Thomas Edward Caldwell, the apparent leader of this effort, who's based in Virginia, was talking to Crowell was talking to Caldwell, and he says, "We'll probably call you tomorrow, mainly because I like to know WTF plan is. You are the man, all caps, commander." So these are folks who were taking whatever training they might have from the military and not just applying it in the planning, but there seemed to be a hierarchy within this planning group as well. Is that what it seems?
That appears to be the case based on the FBI charging documents.
Well, what do we know about any plans to do a similar action in Columbus?
I don't have any information on that other than, what Crowell sort of communicated, basically saying it seemed to be, okay, we've done it at the Capitol, now let's take local action. And I guess being from Ohio, it's natural for him to say Columbus. So.
And state officials have had, in Michigan, for example, the governor there, Governor Whitmer, has there was an entire group that was busted for allegedly planning some sort of kidnapping and possible assassination attempt on her there. We've seen state officials at this level in our area closer to home receiving significant threats as well. Talk about what charges these folks face now and whether investigators are still looking, as far as you know, for people who might be connected to any local plans.
I think there's, still a lot of investigation going on, a lot of people possibly targeted. He was not part of this militia, but there's a retired Navy SEAL from Ohio who was there. He claims not to have gone inside. I think it's a pretty wide investigation right now. I'm sure we'll know a lot more, a few weeks from now than we do today, just as, on Monday, I had never heard of the Ohio State Regular Militia, and now I know a good bit about it.
Certainly, and we're learning a lot of names for these pop-up groups all around the country, and they appear to be coordinating with one another. What do we expect to happen next? Are we following this case further? Are there court appearances on the horizon as far as you know, Dan?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Donovan Crowell has a appearance before a federal magistrate in Dayton. But the cases will eventually all move into the District of Columbia, U.S. District Court.
So they will ultimately face justice, if necessary, in the nation's capital where they allegedly participated in these events?
That's my understanding, yes.
That is Dan Sewell, the Cincinnati-based reporter for the Associated Press. Dan, we appreciate you making your first appearance with us. I hope it's the first of many. You can read Dan's reporting at the Associated Press, often published in the Inquirer. Dan, thanks so much. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
And just ahead, Cincinnati City Council postpones a vote on a controversial Over the Rhine development. And later, local teachers expressing concern about returning to the physical classroom. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition On Demand. Did you know you can have the show delivered straight to your smartphone every day? Just go to your favorite podcast listening app, search Cincinnati Edition, and subscribe. You'll be able to keep up with all our great conversations with newsmakers, public officials, and other interesting people from the greater Cincinnati region and beyond on the go, anytime, anywhere. It's great for those days you can't tune in to catch us live. Weekdays at noon on 91.7 WVXU. And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. A forthcoming development in Over the Rhine met resistance from some in the community over a perceived lack of affordable housing. So this week, council postponed a vote related to it. And meanwhile, candidates continue to line up for this year's mayoral and council races. The Weekly News Review continues now with Inquirer reporter Sharon Coolidge. Sherry, welcome back to our show.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. I think this is the first time you've been on since the calendar flipped to 2021. It's always great to have you on. And you can join our conversation at 513-419-7100. Let's start with this development in Over the Rhine. Just give us a brief overview of what exactly this project is.
Well, they might have tabled it for a further discussion, but first they had to fight about it all week. So New Year, did I just say that?
Absolutely.
This is the first big thing. So we are on the heels of the three council members being arrested on allegations of corruption. And at the end of last year, we saw a lot of, we're going to vet these projects. It's never going to happen again. Here's this anti-corruption, plan, this one and this one and this one. And there's been no votes on that. None of that's happening. But here we are, a development comes to them. This is at Elm and Liberty in Over the Rhine, and this is a vacant lot. I mean, think tumbleweeds, really. And it's long been a target of, like, this would be a great place to develop. 4 years in the making, they roll it out, 300 apartments, underground garage, pool, rooftop, deck. This is billed as luxury apartments. And that set off some warning bells for some council members who are very concerned about affordable housing.
So before we get into that part of this, are you finding in the shadow of the investigations that are still ongoing involving two members of council for allegedly being involved in pay-to-play schemes, bribery schemes involving developers, that council members are skittish on this particular project because it is the first big development to come before them since those revelations were made?
No one actually really said that. There were some allegations about, like, contributions made to the mayor's political action committee, But I have to say, we did look at that, those allegations. There was an open letter to the mayor and the city manager. We looked at those allegations. Giving in itself is not illegal. Certainly now, I expect there to be a more spotlight on who's giving and when, and expect the Inquirer to do that. And I think everybody really who covers City Hall to take a closer look at that. So that was part of this project. There is no allegations of corruption here. But, you know, I said this on Twitter. You know what would really mean there was no out, like, to actually do an audit of the project and what they said they wanted to do with these projects? And then there wouldn't have been any doubt when this project comes sailing through and they're like, here it is. Okay, we need to vote on it tomorrow because it's imperative. We're past the deadline. It's typical. It was typical City Hall. Typical.
What can you tell us about the developers of this particular project?
You know, they're like Ohio developers, so they're not, you know, the normal people that you hear that want to develop, but they took this over. This was a smaller scale project, and it just wasn't, and council, you know, approved it as the smaller parcel. It really wasn't getting it done with the bank. Bank financing is, you know, we don't talk a lot about that in City Hall, but that's the developer end of things, right? Like, what's really going to work? Is it going to make money? Is the bank going to give you a loan to build all of this? And this smaller piece, it never really came together with the bank financing. So the city, you know, turned over some land, made it a bigger parcel, made it more, you know, appealing to a developer to get something done. And it's going to include this Freeport Alley. Technically, the project is called that, Freeman, Freeport, one of those two. and it's a lovely, it's going to be like this artist's alleyway, and the renderings are really pretty. But they took this over and they're like, we can make this work, but not with an affordable housing piece unless there's more incentives.
We're talking about OTR-based Keene Ventures and Buckingham Companies. And so what were they seeking exactly from City Council, which voted on a vote, right? This was a vote on whether or not to vote.
They did. They actually were. I mean, John Cranley put this on the agenda. He was calling for a vote on this. And these developers are like, we're shovel ready. We got to do this. The financing is, you know, there's a date here and a date here. And so the package that came before City Council, pretty much the last minute, the public only saw it on Tuesday. Some people are like, the council members were briefed last week, but that's still behind the scenes. It's a $19 million tax incentive package, which on its face is really, that's not that out of the ordinary. I think it just opened up this bigger conversation about who's getting incentives to build what, which this conversation has been coming, and it's been more tepid and like, here's the policy we'd like to do, and here's another policy we'd like to do, and nobody really cares that much when everybody says policy, everybody's eyes glaze over. It's like, do you want to hear, read a story about balanced development scorecards? Not really, but it does actually really matter. This project, it all came crashing down on this project and these developers who were like, what? We thought this was fine, but it is not fine. And it just opened up. It's just a lightning rod for every conversation we have in the city. What should over the line Rhine look like? How much historic things should we preserve related to it? Should it be all luxury housing? How does this push people out in like the rising costs? And this is a conversation going on in a lot of neighborhoods, and it crashed down right on this project.
And so there are no rules currently related to this part of town that mandate a certain amount of affordable housing. According to your reporting, Sherry, the rents in this project would range between $1,400 to $2,800 a month. And I'm wondering, what were the community activists arguing for? Obviously, that those can be expensive for a lot of people.
I mean, that's not affordable housing, and no one honestly is pretending it is. And sometimes these projects do pretend to be affordable housing with these studio apartments that really are like 30% of, like, you know, middle class people's rent. That's not affordable housing. It has like these technical government definitions, but here, you know, they're talking about the people who live in Over the Rhine should not be pushed out. They're not technically being pushed out. It's vacant, but if you put all these people there and then the value of the neighborhood goes up, that Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney, the councilwoman, her argument was it is going to push out these people. They're being priced out of Over the Rhine. And you think about, you know, it's even a bigger, I mean, I say every issue the city has comes crashing down on it. I really mean it, because it's not just talking about the rents, like moving people in, and you raise the property values, which technically is a good thing. But you're talking about, you know, the tax bill that people pay, then the sewer bill, right? That's very high compared to other counties around us. And they're worried that people are being pushed out of this neighborhood, and other neighborhoods are really talking about this right now. You're hearing this in Madisonville with a lot of, like, this is gentrification. They've come into city council to complain that they're worried that longtime residents can't stay. And so that was a big conversation about this.
So by a vote of 7-2 with the Republican council members, Steve Gooden and Betsy Sunderman voting against, it was decided that the what was up for consideration at City Hall would be postponed until this project could be reviewed further. What was the developer's...
Council members Sunderman and Gooden, they're like, look, let's have this conversation. We want to set some policy? Let's set some policy. It is not fair to these developers at the last second to say, you have to include affordable housing. This was cooked into their plan a long time ago. Like, we'll have this conversation, but you cannot deter developers from coming here. And this is, that's actually another big conversation happening around it, because will people be deterred from wanting to develop in Cincinnati in the wake of what we're hearing behind the scenes? I mean, the U.S. District Attorney for the Southern District said there is a culture of corruption at City Hall. That is not exactly hanging out a welcome sign and saying, come develop here. And then if you're going to fight over every single project, which they all promise, you know, there's a lot of kumbaya moments in December. We have new members and we're all getting along, and that did not turn out to be true today. And I'm not actually saying they need to get along, because these conversations are great, but they did say they were going to. But there was a lot of fighting this week. And so that's a conversation around this too. And so they wanted it to go. It's why they said, let's not hold it 2 weeks. Like, they don't feel like affordable housing is going to get put into this project at the last second here.
We'll note that the developer Keen Ventures issued a statement, according to your reporting, Sherry, where they said they're disappointed with the outcome of that vote and that they've been in the works on this project for years. And quote, that said, we believe in the transformative nature of this project and will continue to engage on potential improvements over the next 2 weeks to ensure it's the best it can be. Sherry, I'm sure we'll be talking about this project again. We're talking with Sharon Coolidge, a reporter with the Cincinnati Enquirer. You and your colleague, Jason Williams, host a podcast at the Enquirer that's so Cincinnati, and it's enjoyable. And you recently spoke with newly elected and sworn in Hamilton County Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey. And one area she hopes to focus on is not building a jail, but building up the self-esteem of inmates. Tell us about Sheriff McGuffey and her early days in office and what she means by that.
You know, we wanted to have her as a guest on the podcast. People are really interested. She has big ideas and she's not afraid to say them. And she is very much who she was on the campaign trail and right out of the gate. So Charmaine McGuffey, let's call her the sheriff. I've known her a long time. And so, but not first names, respect. Sheriff McGuffey, she worked in the jail from when she was very young. She was a deputy. And so she was telling us, she said something in passing, like that she missed the inmates. She had been gone. She'd been fired for a little bit. She won a lawsuit related to that. And she said she missed the inmates. And I was like, tell us about that. Because that's not a sentence you think that people you would hear a lot. And that's not really, I don't think what we hear when we were talking about the sheriff, it's the policies and the money and what are you going to do? And not necessarily always focused on the people on who are in the jail right now. And that's her focus. She said dignity of life for these inmates. They're going to return to their home communities and they need to value themselves. And so they can turn their lives around and not just, I mean, she laid it right out there. She's like, it's really easy to go and, you know, buy heroin on a corner. And she's like, I don't want them to do that. She's like, I want them to have the dignity to say, I can be better. I can do better. And it was really a moving conversation about how she feels about things.
But Sheriff McGuffey in your podcast said that she's, quote, not pie in the sky. I am very law and order, she said. Can you talk a little bit about what she meant by that?
I mean, I don't think, you know, I think a lot of people when they hear social justice reforms, they're like, ooh, these really bad guys are going to be out on the street. And that's just not who she is. She understands when you're in there for a serious crime, you need to be in there. And not just, oh, released. She's law and order in that way. She understands that the jail is there for a reason and it does help keep the community safe. But it can also be a transformative place so that it's just not in and out all the time, that she can make real changes in our community with recidivism, and make the community safer from, you know, the inside out instead of just, you know, punishment.
You can listen to that episode of That's So Cincinnati involving Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey at Cincinnati.com. It's hosted by reporter Sharon Coolidge and columnist Jason Williams. Before we let you run, though, Sherry, if we can borrow a little bit more of your time, let's go back to City Hall for a moment, because it's not just kumbaya, as you referred to it, and rebuilding relationships and listening to developments with maybe a new lens based on the indictments that came out last year. There's an election. We just got out of an election year, but locally there's an election this year, a very important one involving the mayor's office and city council. And it's pretty wild already just by the sheer number of people who have announced their candidacies. It's not unusual to have a large field for council, but it does seem a bit unusual to have this large of a field for mayor, particularly viable or well-known candidates.
Definitely. Like, if you look at the last race, you know, Rob Richardson Jr., John Cranley, Yvette Simpson, these known names, these people with proven track records, whether you like them or not, you know, they like resumes, serious resumes to run for mayor. And so, but three people, right? Because not everyone has that big, long resume and is ready. People that feel like, okay, you're going to be the next mayor of Cincinnati. It is the third largest city in Ohio, even though it's our own small, big city. But this time, and P.G. Sittenfeld was supposed to be the front runner, and his indictment, it is game on for who's going to run for mayor. I mean, you have these four council members who are term limited out. Three are said they're running and one might. I mean, so we're talking about like everyone on council who can run for mayor really might do that. And these other well-known candidates, it's a big field.
And Aftab Purval, the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts, has also announced that he's going to run for mayor as well. Of course, he was elected to the Hamilton County Clerk of Courts, had also run unsuccessfully for Congress against Steve Shabbat in the previous cycle to last year. And what does that do to the race? Because I'm looking at someone like Aftab Purval getting into the race after you see other Democrats announcing either a full run or an exploration of a run, like Wendell Young, Chris Seelbach, David Mann. It looks like natural allies are possibly going to be facing off in this.
Well, and not only natural allies of people who get along with each other, although not maybe totally as well as it seems because they're all Democrats, because they have the same ideals. I think if you're a voter and you don't know them, right, of course they have their bases and people feel like they know them. But if you're just looking at these candidates' resumes, let's say, right, they have a lot of the same ideals or they're very close to each other. And you're like, I think it's going to be really, it'll be interesting to see. You pick one, it's a field that narrows to two. But I think that's going to be really hard for a lot of people. I mean, you talk to like, you know, these tried and true Democrats and they're like, normally you would be like, okay, you expect them to be endorsing people and now they're going to be standing behind them. PG had like, they're a who's who of the Democratic Party stood behind him. You don't see that anymore because the people are like, well, I like these three people and it's going to be really hard to pick. And we haven't really seen this, you know, party support yet in the mayor's race because it's going to be so hard to pick.
So we had maybe anticipated in some forecasting a mayoral campaign between council members P.G. Sittenfeld and David Mann. David Mann is still a candidate. Is Councilman Sittenfeld still planning to run for mayor?
Well, this is not a surprise. You know, I think his natural instinct, he's on social media and he's a talker. We heard from him, you know, that really in the limited 2-3 days after he had been indicted, that, you know, he said he's basically was like, I'm still running. I think there's been some time to digest what's going on. He has like this stellar legal team. And you know what stellar legal teams do? They tell you to be quiet. So no one is talking to PG. So the last thing we heard is like right away, before anybody's had any time to process what this really means or any of the details of the case. Like next week, we are going to hear a lot of things in this case. There are motions due. Because he has asked for this case to be dismissed. He says he is innocent. He laid it all out in the filing. And he also asked that all of the evidence be released. He's saying, because there's a gag order on that. That's not unusual. And he's like, it'll, you know, really shed me in this much better light. I think that they they chose things to put in there, and it's not as bad as it seems, everybody. So next week, we see the federal prosecutors respond to those, you know, what PG is saying. And I think we're going to hear a lot more about this case next week. But anyway, he has not talked. I'm not surprised he hasn't talked, but that is a very unusual place to be in if you're running for mayor of a city.
And before we let you run, Sherry, this list could still grow yet. You reported earlier this month some people who are still considering jumping in. So in addition to current members of council, current members of the Ohio legislature, you're talking about possibly former Mayor Mark Mallory, former councilman and Hamilton County Commissioner and Ohio Democratic Party Chairman David Pepper, current councilman Chris Smitherman might be reevaluating his options here, and Hamilton County Commission President Denise Driehaus also. Any movement on any of those fronts?
I would say all eyes are on Mark Mallory. He feels this calling. I had a chance to talk to him. I've talked to him several times, like, you know, are you running? With the same answer of, I haven't decided yet. But I had a chance to talk to him at length when I wrote a story that what's wrong with city government, like after PG was arrested. And he feels so passionate about this city. It's ingrained in him and good government. And I think he just feels a calling. David Pepper, I think he is seriously considering it. He has this higher bar because he does not live in the city and he would need to move in there into the city. And he is very aware of that. So those two, all eyes are on. For some of these other people, I would watch for Jason Williams' column this weekend. I don't want to, get ahead of some things that he and I have been talking about. But I think that's really where, and Christopher Smitherman is very interesting. He said he was running. His wife, before she passed away of cancer, said she wanted him to run for mayor. This was their plan. But of course, in the wake of her death, it's very difficult. 5 children, one of them, is in 7th grade. He wanted to be a dad. So he said he wasn't running for that reason. And who couldn't understand that, right? He's a single father. You get that. But he too does feel this calling. And so he said he was reconsidering. And then I was kind of like, no, you're not really reconsidering. You still have all those same issues. But lately, I have really gotten the feeling he's closer to a yes than a no.
Interesting.
So I'm not ruling out a run by Christopher Smitherman.
Well, regardless of who's running and who gets elected, they'll be seeing Shirley Coolidge at City Hall. And we're going to have a lot to read from you in the coming weeks and months, and hopefully a lot to talk with you about on this program. Shirley Coolidge from The Inquirer, thanks so much for the time you gave us today. Always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
And this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. We continue the weekly news review now with WVXU reporters Jolene Almendarez. Hi, Jolene.
Hi, how are you?
I bet you were muted a second too long there, Jolene. That's all right.
Just one second.
Jolene joins us via Zoom, as does Corey Sharber. Hey, Corey.
Hey, Michael.
All right. Let's start with you, Jolene. No-knock warrants is a term a lot of us learned for the first time in the wake of the death of Breonna Taylor at the hands of police in Louisville. The issue of no-knock warrants arrived at City Hall. What was the discussion and what happened?
Right. So this has been an issue that's been ongoing since, I believe it was last March, right after the death of Breonna or the killing of Breonna Taylor. A lot of people were looking into what happens with no-knock warrants locally. And to be honest, there are still a lot of questions. There's a lot of data that people don't know from the city. Like specifically, the city hasn't released how many no-knocks are done each year, for instance, for the past 10 years. And who they're served upon. But people still wanted to pass something to regulate how no-knocks are carried out in Cincinnati. And so what that looked like at City Council is the coming together of a lot of people to basically say that they only want to use no-knock warrants in extreme emergency situations, like a terrorist attack, a hostage situation, if there's been a murder or something like that. And there's a lot of support, it seems like, on council for those kinds of changes. The problem is that it seems that the police chief and city attorney did not play as active as a role as a lot of people thought that they should when proposing these changes. And it just became a question of whether city council can really ask them or has the authorization to require them to pass these kinds of changes.
And so it appears that it was as though a motion like this, if it were adopted, it would mostly just be a suggestion. It wouldn't have any teeth.
Exactly. It wouldn't. So I believe what council, what was decided, it was decided that they'd hold off for a little while and just try to get more input from the police chief and the city manager to kind of reach a middle ground and say, like, look, hey, this is what council wants to do. Can you work with us? What part of this is practical and reasonable? What does and doesn't work? And so they're going to be doing that, and then it's going to likely come back for a vote.
Councilwoman Jan Michelle Kearney requested data on how many no-knock warrants are granted. Nobody at the meeting knew. I should note that WVXU submitted a public records request for similar data back in November, and you still haven't gotten that information, right?
I haven't, but after I mentioned that on Twitter, I did receive an email from the police department essentially saying, look, we don't really keep records in the way you requested, but that they're going to be gathering this data and releasing it. They didn't provide a time frame. They said COVID-19 has stressed their records department. I'm not really sure how that worked, but they said that they're working on getting it for us. Now, the reason data really matters, and Councilwoman Jan Michelle Lemon Kearney mentioned this, is that nationwide, it seems that no-knock warrants are executed upon Black suspects and in neighborhoods that are also historically Black a lot more than they are in for non-Black suspects. And so people do want to see, like, hey, if they're going to keep doing no-knock warrants locally, even with these tighter restrictions, they want to see how this plays out and any bias that maybe sneaking its way in when these things happen, because they are very dangerous to do.
Let's turn now to Corey Sharber. Corey, it looks like some students are headed back to the classroom in Cincinnati public schools after a decision that was made last Saturday in a long board meeting that you worked and covered. But not everybody is excited about that. What can you tell us?
Right. A lot of teachers were really frustrated with the recent decision the board made. So on Saturday, the public school board announced a return to blended learning starting on February 1st. That decision was made just days after Hamilton County reached the highest level on the Ohio Public Health Advisory System, which indicates that COVID-19 is spreading at a very high rate. Now, of course, with all these decisions being made, back in December, when they originally were laying out plans to return to blended learning, they were hoping that the city would remain below 40 new daily COVID-19 cases per 100,000 people. Now, when the board made this decision, the city was averaging 66 new daily cases. And of course, at the board meeting this week, I believe at the time, Cincinnati was reporting 53 new daily cases a day. So the decision is being made at a time where the virus isn't even at the level the board originally wanted it to be at. Now, a lot of teachers, of course, are really frustrated, but this is not just because, one, you're dealing with, you know, going back to work when the virus is even more dangerous than it was when they originally went to distance learning, but also because of some of the guidelines involving some of the classrooms, most notably at Walnut Hills. They've introduced a plan that would have students spaced 3 feet apart within the classrooms rather than at 6 feet. And the interesting thing about that is back in June 10th of last year, they did a presentation involving the academic and safety risk presented with COVID-19. And what they said was the highest risk for COVID safety was having full-size in-person classrooms with social distancing not at 6 feet. So all of these decisions are kind of, it's kind of odd that the data being presented is kind of not being, like, is not what's guiding the decision to return to the class.
So I note that board member Mike Morosky made a motion to delay the return until March 1. It seems that people are optimistic with the vaccines coming out, educators being among those priority groups early on to receive the vaccine, that it might be safer to wait several months, but that didn't move anywhere.
Right, that went nowhere. And of course, like as you mentioned, with the vaccine distribution within the county, even last week, Commissioner Denise Driehaus said that the county wasn't even getting enough vaccine to get through phase 1A of the vaccine distribution plan. So there's a lot of worries, you know, especially with February 1st, when the return to blended learning starts, the classrooms that are going to be returning are preschool, kindergarten through third grade classrooms and specialized classrooms. Now, of course, specialized classrooms and preschool are going to be in person 4 days a week. And the big risk with specialized classrooms is that some of those students are just exempt from mask wearing due to whatever disabilities they have, which, of course, creates a huge risk for the teachers of those classrooms.
Meanwhile, Corey, the Hamilton County Board of Elections Early Vote Center will become forever remembered during this period of vaccine distribution. What's going to happen there?
Right. So today, the Hamilton County Board of Elections Early Vote Center is becoming the main COVID-19 vaccine clinic for the county. Vaccines are going to be administered by appointment only. And you also have to meet the age requirement right now, which is currently ages 80 and up. The big reason why they selected this facility as the County Director of Elections, Sherry Poland, pointed out is that the facility is over 15,000 square feet, which gives the health department enough space to administer the vaccine safely. And it also allows for a greater amount of people to come there and still be safe while getting the vaccine. She also pointed out that 80,000 residents of the county already voted early there during the election. So that means 80,000 people in the county already know where it is, which means, you know, it's a quick location. Everyone, if 80,000 people already know where this location is, there's a good chance a lot of them are eligible to get the vaccine. So having them get that quick access in a safe way, you know, makes a huge difference.
That's Corey Sharber. Let's go back to Jolene Almendarez. Very quickly, you had a lovely story this week about the uptick in adoptions here in Hamilton County and the way that adorable photos of those kids may have played a role. What can you tell us?
Right. So the new Judge Ralph Winkler, has essentially said that he has a lot of experience with the foster care system. He's taking care of children. He has relatives who've tried to adopt. And it's kind of an issue that's near and dear to his heart. And so when he became a judge back in 2015, he moved from a criminal court into a different kind of court. And one thing he noticed is that in criminal courts, something he saw was that a lot of the people had like abusive childhoods. And it made him wonder if you could get kids into safer, supportive families, would it be possible to just really change the trajectory of their life? And so he's been doing social media posts and posting these adorable photos of kids and families when they go through the adoption procedure in his court. And it has caused an uptick. There are hundreds more people who have been adopted than would otherwise be adopted. Now, there may be other factors at play there, but in the surrounding counties, there has not been a similar uptick. It's mostly been stagnant. So this push by him to do a lot more publicity, share these adorable photos, seems to have made at least a little bit of a difference, or a major difference, I'd say.
You can read and listen to that report and the other ones we discussed today at WVXU.org. My thanks to WVXU reporters Corey Sharber and Jolene Almendarez. Thanks for being with us. Have a great weekend.
You too.
Thanks for having me.
And joining us now to wrap up the weekly news review is another WVXU reporter, Tana Weingartner. Tana, thanks for being with us.
I'm excited to be here.
I'm glad you're here. And so let's talk mental health. We know that that's been a topic of discussion since the COVID-19 pandemic began, as we're learning new ways to be stressed and scared. Miami University is leading a statewide effort in schools for mental wellness and health. And that's been a particular area of concern.
Right. Obviously, mental health problems have ticked up during the pandemic. So Miami's leading the Ohio School Wellness Initiative. It's a 21-month plan. It started this month, and it's ultimately the funding comes out of CARES Act dollars. You know, it goes through a bunch of little phases, but it'll have three sort of key components. This is implementing an Ohio version of the student assistance program that's based on recommendations from Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. It's also going to strengthen what are known as tier two and tier three intervention programs addressing mental health, behavioral health, and substance use. So those are kind of also the three areas that this is looking at: behavioral health, mental health, and then substance use among K through 12 students. And then the third component of it is making sure that teachers and staff also have access to mental health supports.
So how did Miami University land this opportunity to lead the effort statewide?
They have a center there, Miami Center for School-Based Mental Health Programs. So they're going to be the ones that are running it. The idea is to kind of create a clearinghouse of where all of the supports and things that the state is offering and that local districts and things offer, put them all kind of together in one place so it's easier to find, but then also to create teams that are strategically around the state. So, you know, if it's a particular district and they're having issue with, you know, that they need to address, they can go to their team. They don't have to go to that central clearinghouse. You know, it's just easier. And then the idea is that when this 21-month program is over, all of the supports are still in place. Those teams are still in place. Everything is still there. So it continues. It's like a legacy program.
Let's move on, Tana, to what we lovingly refer to as the Tanimal Report, when you give us updates in the world of biology and the zoo. We've been asking our technical director, Josh Elstrow, to give you a theme song. He has not done that, though I believe he has resolved in 2021 to do so. The story of the week involves snakes. What
yes.
did a local researcher learn as part of a team? I don't like this.
Okay, so let's just get it off the bat. We're talking about the brown tree snake here. It is not yet in the United States, like United States proper. So biologist Bruce Jane and his colleagues from the Colorado State University discovered that there are five ways. We already knew there were four. There is now a new fifth way that snakes can climb. The brown tree snake, it's called lasso locomotion. Basically, it can wrap itself around something that it wants to climb, create a lasso with its tail, like hook its little prehensile tail, and then use the muscles in the sides of it to sort of like shimmy. So like, you know, the lasso holds it in place and then it kind of shimmies up and then it can slowly climb whatever it wants to climb. Now, this is important because they kind of noticed that in Guam, where this is a highly invasive species, they've been trying to protect the bird populations because this brown tree snake has just decimated native bird populations. And they've been trying to figure out, like, so they, you know, they have nesting boxes for the birds and things, and yet the snakes were still getting to the birds. And they couldn't figure out why, and they eventually figured out it's using this way of climbing. And that's important because now if you know how they can climb, you can stop them.
Oh, man.
Okay. So then I guess the other kicker here, right, is that they aren't just eating the bird population.
Oh, stop.
When they climb all these poles and things, they cause massive power outages on Guam.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's really bad. So it's like the Burmese python situation in the Everglades, except for, you know, Professor Jane says it's probably worse because it's causing power outages. Now, here's where we get to the snakes on the plane that I've been talking about. Since they're such good climbers and they're sneaky, how they got to Guam in the first place is they kind of stowed away post-World War II on all of the shipping vessels that were going from Indonesia and Australia to Guam. So now we're worried that they're sneaking onto vessels and planes bound for the United States. So they have made it to Hawaii. They have taken planes to Hawaii, but so far as we know, they have not become, they haven't taken hold in Hawaii.
My goodness, these snakes climb trees, eat birds, and service travel agents, apparently. It's very crazy the way they get around. Tana Weingartner, read more of her reporting at WVXU.org. Tana, thank you for being with us.
Hey, happy birthday to you and Fiona this weekend.
Thank you.